Welcome to the latest episode in the Delivery Podcast. I'm delighted to have Ruth Meyer Webster, IJ Samuel, and Mary Gregory with me. We're going to be exploring the subject of bias. When I was working at the Major Projects Association, one of the series we developed, one of the video series we developed, were little 90-second interviews where I asked people from across the major project space, what did you learn early in your career that you particularly took to heart and that you've used ever since? And what one piece of advice would you pass on to the next generation of project professionals? And the intention was very deliberate. I was looking for people's heuristics. Well, what are the rules of thumb that people use to help them get through the complex world of work and of major projects? And I kind of wonder, we talk about bias, we talk about unconscious bias, and I wonder what is the difference between that and heuristics? Because we, on the one hand, we say heuristics good, yes, they allow us to make decisions in at times when there's a lot of uncertainty. Bias bad, and it's almost a 1984 kind of yes, two legs good, or two legs bad, four legs good kind of dichotomy. So I thought I'd just start by asking each of you to give your perspective on this subject. Ruth, you're top left of my screen, so perhaps I could ask you to kick off.
I'm just wondering where to dive in. I guess I should just, for context, say that Jonathan and I have been talking about this for more than, well, nearly 20 years, because Jonathan published my first book on this topic with David Hilson called Understanding and Managing Risk Attitude. So I've been thinking about this, particularly how the human aspects of decision making under uncertainty play out in practice, and especially in a major project context, which is my world. So how it affects estimates, how it affects, risk management, how we proactively deal with things, how we build in resilience, those sorts of things. And in that original work, and we sort of developed it a little bit since then, but we talked about the triple strand of influences on perception of risk and therefore our action and behaviors. Now, this is not perfect, and I'm sure we will maybe unpick or finesse what I'm going to say next. But at the time, we were saying, well, there are three strands of influence that just affect our perception of whether something is risky or not. Some of those are at the conscious level. I have experience of this, my experience was great and therefore, or my experience was bad and therefore, but something that's very much at a conscious level. I wonder whether some of our prejudice, our prejudgments are also at a conscious level. Sometimes they're choices, aren't they? So conscious factors. Then we talked about subconscious factors. Now, at the time when David and I were doing this work, we did differentiate between heuristics and cognitive biases. So I'll just give you my take, and I'm not saying it's right. But we talked about heuristics as being rules of thumb. Mental shortcuts help us cut through, the sort of noise and messiness. And that they may bias us. So, for example, we know that the availability heuristic is something that means that we favor most recent that most recent information is most memorable. So, if you after the terrible the jumbo jets into the Twin Towers in America, people stopped flying, and the data for deaths in road accidents went through the roof. But the perception was it was too dangerous to fly because of the availability heuristic. So sometimes those are bad heuristics and do bias. I think that sometimes they probably don't. So maybe one to explore later. And then cognitive biases, my understanding is that they are about how we think about the world, about our cognition and therefore act. But that cognitive biases are factors that we know would always bias if we adopted them. So let us think about something that's called the precautionary principle, which is a better safe than sorry bias. Now, sometimes that would mean that we would, make really poor decisions about taking up an opportunity because we're too cautious. I always think about the illusion of control. And when I'm behind the wheel of my car, I always have an illusion of control. I think I'm safe. And the bigger and newer your car, you think you're even safer. And it's nonsense. It's a trick. And in projects, obviously the one that everyone talks about is optimism bias, that even knowing that all of these things might go differently, well, it won't happen to me. So that's others, won't happen to me. So loads of examples of that. So that was the second strand. And then the third strand we called the affective strand. So actually emotions. And this is something I really care about. I think that emotions are underplayed in business. Fortunately, in the last 20, 25 years, I think that is changing. And particularly through really a much greater acceptance of practices like executive coaching, that people will talk about fear or shame or desire or anger. And I have a theory that those things actually affect our perception and almost biases more than anything else. But those all things together, it's all complex. And we talked about the triple strand because there were three things. But if you imagine if those strands were tightened, I know on this podcast, no one can see what I'm doing with my fingers, sort of trying to make a really tight three strand structure, then at the point of making a decision, we haven't a clue what's really affecting us. We just know that, well, I'm seeing it like I'm seeing it. And sometimes that serves us well. Most of the time it does. But I guess my interest is in really risky and important decisions, are we deluding ourselves and should we do more? So I'll stop there, but hopefully that gets us going.
Thanks so, so much, Ruth. I mean, just an observation before I move on to IJ. I think the effective thread and emotion is coming to the fore now. I think, the work on psychological safety particularly picks up the importance of emotions. Which I'm really delighted to see. So, IJ, what's your take on this?
Listening to Ruth and all of the strands that she talked about, they're quite insightful. From my perspective, if we have delved into biases, there's circa just looking into so many biases, over 180 psychological biases, if we have to go into every single one of them. My interest when it comes to project delivery, especially being on major projects as well, it's what does that do? I think Ruth, you articulated it as you summarized there. How do we make decisions based on whether they're implicit biases, whether they're explicit from a cognitive perspective or subconscious perspective? What does that mean for us from how we make key decisions that actually affect not just the projects and outputs we deliver, but the lives, the communities that we serve and represent as we go through what we do as people, being the heart of project delivery. And that's really for me where it gets interesting. We can systemize processes, we can systemize our approach, but there's no magic wand to fix people. And that's where my interest comes from when we talk about cognitive biases, when we talk about implicit biases, when we talk about, I think one of the things that got me interested when I was looking into this over the years is about the percentage of projects that fail and what that means. And when you attribute it to, I think there was a study done by Said Business School, yeah, Oxford, where I think it's about 0.5, less than 1% of projects out of about 12 to 15,000 projects that were sampled, less than 1% were delivered on time, on budget, within benefits that we set out to deliver. And then looking into the factors, obviously there's so many reasons why projects fail. But when you delve deep into some of the factors where why it was running late, overspending, you start delving deep into things like optimism bias, which Ruth mentioned, but as well as some of the heuristics where people had been on major projects for over the years, They've got 30 years of experience. We know how we did this in that project, on that project, and therefore it doesn't apply to this one. Even for myself as well, in my experience over the years, when it comes to things like risk management, I would know a percentage of risk that goes well with certain types of projects. So I'll be looking for my risk managers to say, oh, it falls within 15%. I'm like, oh yeah, for that nature of project, that's about right. Okay. And then I'm consciously working on this every time, because then when I'm going through the information presented, possibly I may not go through the same level of rigor, because somewhere I already believe with my mental shortcuts, 15% sounds about right for that project. There could be something else that will blow it out of the water if I took my time to stand back and review it to the level of detail that I would if that data told me that it was 30%. I'm like, no, I don't think it should be 30. What's wrong? What did you do wrong? And then I'm paying more attention. So those are some of the examples where heuristics and unconscious bias, they go hand in hand, because whilst heuristics are really good, mental shortcuts, you get to the answer very quickly. Sometimes you have to make decisions on the spot, and that leads you to a quicker outcome. But on the other hand, there are those unconscious biases that if we don't always stop and check ourselves, they can manifest in how we make decisions on projects. And that's an area where I'm really keen, and I'm sure we'll get to unpacking what we can do to help ourselves, help people on our teams, also to manage our own biases, our own heuristics, mental shortcuts as we go through project life cycle or even day-to-day life on its own. So I'll pause there, and hopefully we will keep unpacking the subject. There's a lot in here.
Thanks ever so much, IJ. Mary, I mean, the three of us, we all come from this strange world of major projects. So I'm hoping you're going to provide some balance.
I'm just thinking, because my world is all about leadership and helping organizations and leaders be as effective as they can be. And of course, there's going to be project elements in that, because they're always leading change across the organization. So there'll be projects associated with that. But what I'm really interested in is the whole relational piece, because I believe leadership is all about the relationships you build with people, the way you engage with people. And I write a lot about ego, because I think ego, which is full of biases and full of all the things that you've been talking about so far, is often where we're at. And in fact, at least 80% of the time I'm probably an ego. Well, I am an ego talking to you right now, because I'm putting my opinions across and probably being very right about them as well. So the whole thing for me is that bias is everywhere. And the more we can make it conscious for ourselves, the more effective we're going to be, the more we notice what those biases are, and the more we can therefore make. I think I love that Ruth mentioned the whole thing about choice. When we're not so much in bias, we're making a conscious choice around something, being aware of how our biases affect us. But it's like the peeling of the onion, isn't it? I don't know about you, but I've had moments in my own development where I've gone through and had some, oh gosh, you know, I'm now aware of all these biases. But as soon as I've become aware of that, or that element of myself, I then suddenly become aware that there's another set over, you know, it's like it's kind of a never ending evolving journey. So that's kind of what's there for me. But also my whole take on it is that my particular interest is also around gender. And how we are biased, how our behavior is influenced by our biases. So you put that in the context of the project world. You know, for example, there's that wonderful book, The Authority Gap by Marianne Sygard, which has all sorts of research in it about how men get listened to more than women. And yet women have to prove their competence so much more than men do. Men can just behave in a confident way and they'll be believed, whereas a woman won't necessarily. You think about that in the context of a project, particularly if it's a high risk project, and the woman might be trying to state her case that I'm just not sure we should be going in this direction, but a man is saying it very confidently, and therefore he gets listened to more than the woman would get listened to. That for me is where biases become really, really risky, if we're not aware of them and we're not conscious of them.
That's a lovely perspective. Thank you, Mary. I You know, I'm very aware of, and it'd be good to move on to the question of gender, and I think we should, because I'm very aware of that. And one thing that struck me as extraordinary was when I joined the Major Projects Association, I was still fundamentally me, nothing changed, and yet people would listen to me and welcome me into their fold. And when I left, they no longer wanted to listen to me. So there was a bias about the fact that I was an MPA employee. I could pick up the mic and people would listen to me. And yet I'm still the same person that I was before and during. So that's extraordinary. So I'd love to pick up the question of gender. And I just put it to Ruth and IJ. I'll shut up because I'm a man. So what's your sense of this?
For me, from a personal perspective, being a female on major projects, being a Black woman on major projects, it comes up different angles for me and for people who also look up to me as a role model in the industry as well. My take on gender bias, it's real, especially when it comes to major projects. In project delivery, it's real. What I'm really proud of is the journey that the industry has been over the years. So the awareness of the scale of the challenge is there in terms of whether it's, as Mary talked about, as a woman, you're saying something and someone articulates the same idea and other people listen to you, or the authority bias that you talked about there, Jonathan, where you were an employee of MPA and then you stepped away and people didn't listen to you. It also plays out from a gender bias perspective. The part of it that is quite worrying for me is that we have been over the years waiting for legislation to move the dial when it comes to gender bias. Until we had the gender pay gap reporting that became legislation, till then the dial did not move at all, regardless of how much awareness we had. What I'm mindful of when it comes to any type of bias, whether it's gender bias, affinity bias, on whether it's improving for people with disability or different characteristics or ethnicity and all of that, we don't want legislation to be the driver for change. We want the human behaviors, we want leadership to take charge and put things in place, those institutional changes that we can make before they become legislated to us. So from a gender perspective, just focusing on that, I think the stats are there for us. When I talk about what can we do to improve gender balance, I don't stay and talk about the issue. If you want to know the depth of the challenge, go on Google. The research is endless. I want to focus the conversation around what can we do to move the dial beyond where we are. We talk about representation, lack of representation. We talk about lack of senior role models. If I don't see people, there are only very few people who can be what they can't see. I'm not saying it's not possible to be what you can see. There are trailblazers here and there, but there are few people. A lot of people need role models that they can see. And a lot of organizations talk about, and even I have this challenge in my team as well, where on major projects, the people that have got the experiences, possibly from a gender perspective, the pool is narrow. That's real. But what can we do to pipeline? And that's really, for me, where we talk about setting up projects, spending time upfront, think about how do we build in inclusive outcomes. If we have headcount for 5 people, those 5 people, it depends on the resources available. We can talk about how far out and how wide I can go and look for the right talent. But when you deliver major programs, billion-pound programs, you need senior people who hit the ground running, and then you need a lot more people in your team. If those senior people, regardless of how far out I go into recruitment to diversify my recruitment job boards, if the experiences are not trained in the pipeline over the years, I would not find those people, as many as I want them to be. So my challenge to leaders on major projects will be, how do we then build in that headcount to pipeline? Because if I fill my 5, I have no budget to pipeline for the remainder of the people that I want to bring on board. So those are the sort of areas that I'm really fascinated to look at and have conversations around. How do we move the dial to close the gap and pipeline so that over the next 10, 15 years, we're not talking about awareness, oh, there's an issue, gender imbalance. Yeah, it's been an issue since before I was born, it was an issue. I've been in projects for over the years, it's still an issue. So the awareness is there. We will keep raising awareness, but I want to move from awareness to solution, to moving the dial and to moving us forward. That's my take on it. Sorry, I went on to
that's great. And
a long run there.
I'll just hear from Ruth, and then I think we should move on to this question of moving the dial. How do we address these huge issues? I realize that I feel like I'm walking along on a path, and I've bent down to pick up a pebble, and I've realized that it's actually just a little bit of a boulder that's buried under the ground. Yes. So Ruth.
I'm glad IJ went first then, because I can recognize that as an older woman, I've been working for 45 years now, that I am part of the problem. And the reason why I say that is because I did start work. I have had someone say to me in all seriousness, we like you, love, but you know you're taking a man's job. You know? So now, I haven't had that said to me since my 20s. And at one level, I would say, no, gender's not been an issue for me. I've just got on and I've done what I've done. I'm going to qualify that in a moment. I would say I've had more bias shown to me because I've got a Northern accent. That's real. However, what I've come to realise, actually only fairly recently, and this is partly through a forum that I was involved in on International Women's Day, but also with my daughter and my daughter-in-law, who are much younger women, are the number of little microaggressions or micro effects that are used and that I have accepted because maybe somewhere deep down I believed I was a woman in a man's world. And so the little put downs all the time, you know. So this is a real example. You know, I'm pretty senior consultant in an organization providing some advice in a call with some guys. I said I disagreed with someone, and I made a big point. I think this is wrong, and I will, you know, I am prepared to stand up for this. And a guy went, ooh, feisty. Now, I just took it at the time and then told my daughter, and she went, what, mum? Like, no. Now, I think it's those sorts of things that are just you know, and we're all prejudiced. You know, this is not it's only men. We're all prejudiced in lots of ways. But, you know, as I just said when she was talking about risk, it's not about awareness as a general thing. It's about paying attention and being prepared to do something about it, for all of us to appreciate everybody else and to, you know, sort of cut into those automatic things we say and do that are really poor behaviour.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to ask you now about, so I'll give you a moment to prepare, about how do we start to move the dial and what are the things that we can do practically to address bias in all its forms. And I'll throw in a little prejudice of mine, which is, you know, we talk often about bias and cognitive bias in terms of the individual. And I'm much more interested in the context, in the organization, in the culture, because I'm aware, gosh, certainly in government, you know, there's certain things when I've been to, no, you can't say it like that. We don't, not allowed to say it like that in government. And there's a whole kind of weight of an organization that's weighing down on you. It says you have to use optimism bias, because otherwise you just don't get anywhere. If you don't exaggerate the benefits of your project, if you don't kind of underplay the risks, then you will just be in a world of pain. And even though you know that intellectually it's wrong, you're forced to play the game by the system. So thoughts in terms of moving the dial on any of these aspects of bias in decision making, where would you start?
I'll throw something in just to get us started. I've thought about this for years and years. I don't have the answer. But it's something around what, like, courageous conversations. Being, you know, it's great that we talk about psychological safety a lot in organizations now, but to me, if a context is psychologically safe, then it's also fine to speak up. Yeah, with respect, you know, but that an alternative point of view is a good point of view. And that, you know, be just how we encourage that. And, you know, we all fall into groupthink. We all fall into the safety that goes with numbers. You know, it can be really difficult to speak out. But I think that nowadays, psychological safety is a thing. You know, all of my clients, public and private sector, will be talking about that. And I think we need to seize the day that if we do have psychological safety, that means that we should be able to just, you know, put out an alternative point of view in a different way without trying to go, oh, I'll just be the devil's advocate. You know, which is all a bit weak, isn't it? But just say, actually, I see it from a different point of view. Maybe we could consider this. I think that's part of it. Of course, the enemy of that is that we're all wanting to make decisions quick, fast. So speed is the enemy of that. You sort of need some time, don't you, to really explore different points of view.
So I think also what you've made me think of there, Ruth, as well, isn't, and I've seen this work in project teams, you have to establish this at the beginning, and it's important at the beginning when a project team is coming together to actually take the time to set out some ways of working. And what I, in the coaching world, of course, we call that contracting. So you actually agree a contract of how we are going to be with each other. And you could put, you know, because that is a bedrock of psychological safety to create that. But you could make sure you include in that we agree that we'll call each other out if we hear biased behavior or biased language or whatever. It's okay in this team to call each other out, because it's useful for the project, because if somebody's not being listened to for whatever reason, you want to make sure they get listened to if it's going to affect the outcome of the project. So I think having and it's not a contract as you would call a contract of law. It's a behavioural contract. It's making the implicit explicit around what are our needs and expectations of each other, in terms of how we treat each other, in terms of how we speak of each other, in terms of how we come around making decisions. For example, you can include all of that. But it's linked around behaviour. And that's, from my experience, is what organisations so quickly fall down on, is the behavioural elements. And then once you've got that contract, you're then in a position to hold the team, the project team, to account on it. Are we following through? Are we behaving and treating each other as we said we would do on this project? That for me is certainly a way of tackling it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Mary, because we do assume we're all humans. We know how to behave as adults and to interact with that, even though the last project, it all went horribly wrong and ended up in court, and no, it'll be fine. So yes, that's very good. IJ, what's your take on this?
It's interesting listening to Ruth and Mary coming at it from the perspective of having that safe space, being empowered with that psychological safety, calling each other out, setting those metrics. What I look at when we think about how do we move the dial for unconscious bias to get us in the right way, or gender bias, or any bias for that matter. Having come from oil and gas background, it was grilled into us from a Piper Alpha safety incident way back in 1988 or thereabout. That incident changed the trajectory of health and safety in the industry. And it's set the tone for a long time. And it was an offshoot of so many other safety training and things that have been put in place. And we don't go through a major project without being on top of our safety. We don't go through, it's non-negotiable on any major project, right? We have our clear measures of success, whether it's through our RIDO or LTIs. We have really good metrics of how we show how we're moving the dial and how we're keeping each other safe to make sure that the people who come in to deliver these projects, they go home safe to their families. It's there. When it comes to inclusion, how do we take our biases from project delivery? How do we improve? The metrics are wishy-washy. The metrics are really not there. For anything, I come from a PMO background, and whatever we don't measure, we can't really improve on. Fact. Okay. So I love the let's go in, let's have the safe space, let's empower people to have those healthy conversations, let's call each other out. All of these are really good things that we need to do to start moving the dial in the right direction. But I'm worried that it probably wouldn't move us any quicker to anywhere, because we don't have any clear metrics that we can use to see that we are actually moving the dial in the right direction. When we talk about inclusive outcomes, when we're setting up projects, we talk a good game. Pick up the benefits of any major project and read through, and it will be interesting to see how many actually put it into the values, the outcomes, the benefits, and measurable benefits. There's a social value thumbs that used on public infrastructure projects, and also on some private projects they use it as well. So again, that gives a good indicator of how you should be moving it down when it comes to different areas of inclusion on major projects. I know I'm moving on a little bit from unconscious bias as the main topic of this, but bringing it back home, how do we move the dial? I think for me, it's putting our money where our mouth is. From a leadership perspective, we need to lead from the top and then empower the teams to actually live out these inclusive metrics that we talk about. For me, that's one of the ways that we can stamp out a number of the barriers. We have zero tolerance on safety. Call people out, what's our tolerance level, so that the repercussion of being called out. I mentor a lot of people, and they come to me and say, I can't say nothing, I'm just telling you, and I don't want you to take this anywhere. Because the last time I said something, I know what happened to me. I'm not ready to go through this again. I'm done.
Yes.
I'll just put my head down and get my job done. So yes, they've been empowered to say something. Are they really taking it up? Because the space is not really that safe. But when it comes to safety, we know what we do when there are incidents. We know how the process is all set out. People are not thinking about, oh, will I get called out if I stop work for a safety incident? They're not thinking about that anymore, especially on big projects or on any serious project for that matter. But when it comes to biases and inclusion, people are, you know, they're treading the waters carefully. I don't know what I'm going to say to upset the other one. And it's not, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's a black and white. It's really, there's so many gray areas when it comes to this. But there are areas where we can say, when it comes to whether it's gender inclusion, whether it's from a race and ethnicity, whether it's what we do to improve this, the spaces for diverse disabled colleague, you know, it's just how do we improve spaces for different characteristics? How do we bring that diversity of thoughts into project delivery so that we can actually make sure that we are designing and delivering for the right communities, for the right outcomes at the back end?
This is something about making the implicit explicit, whether it's about saying it, whether it's about behavioral contracts, whether it's about metrics, data. You know, we know that there's lots hidden under the surface, you know, that for humans, that's just a fact. We know there are all these biases out there that we may trip over, fall foul of. And, you know, knowing that, appreciating differences in others, making the implicit explicit, I think has got to be part of it. And whatever we can do to call that out or have metrics or, you know, is can only be a good thing, I think.
We're almost out of time. And I thought I would ask each of you just very briefly, do you have a favorite rule of thumb? And what would it be? What's your go-to rule of thumb? And I'll start this time, Mary, I'll start with you.
It's difficult to separate it from life. I think I have a definite rule of thumb of treat other people as I'd wish to be treated myself. So if I feel like I've been rude to someone or I've been too abrupt, I wouldn't want to be treated like that myself. So I would probably go back on that and make sure that person was okay. But I also think I'm just conscious of today and how often we've mentioned optimism bias. I think like whenever I enter a meeting or any interaction, I always go into with the curiosity of what good will come out of it. So it's I've recognised in myself a lot of optimism bias today. Really, so yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah.
And that's a good thing. That's the thing is a good thing. IJ, what about you?
The one that I go to all the time is the Pareto principle, the 80-20. So when I go out, when I step out each day, I'm thinking, if I get to a good outcome today, I'm going to focus on the 20% of the day and I'll see how much of the 80% I need to put in. But if that 20% beats, so when it's in a meeting or even supporting my kids with schoolwork, if we can get to the 20% of it done, the bit that matter, then hopefully the 80% will take care of itself. So that's my go-to. Again, some of that leads into the optimism bias that Mary talked about, which can then say, yes, I focused on the 20%. It's going to be good, right? Maybe not in some cases, but that's my go-to principle.
Yes. Yeah. Ruth, what about you?
Yeah, I was, Mary stole mine. I was going to say doing to others. Yeah, I think that's a real core value for me. But I've got another one that it's the words of a 70s probably or 80s pop song, which is, and it's what I say to myself is, when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bit of a rallying cry for me when I'm facing things that, feel tough, just like, no, you can do this, and that sometimes also leads to really stupid optimism and illusion of control and all sorts of other things, but it's a little rallying cry to self.
Yeah, excellent. And I'll be a little self-indulgent and share one of mine, which is, what's the worst that can happen? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a definite prejudice about status quo, and I've so often in my career I've found myself railing against an inability to get a decision to take an action because inactivity is seen as a neutral position, instead of recognizing inactivity carrying a cost and a risk. So I can be extraordinarily dilettante, and so I tend to pursue the next shiny thing. So that also plays into that. Listen, thank you so much. It's really been a wonderful conversation. I have got my title. It's going to be making the implicit explicit.